Hello, we are transmitting to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century. Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost. Whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you. This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 869.GE0810, certificate number 23861, Operation Columba.
And G.I. Joe, the greatest military pigeon in history, he is credited with saving the lives of 1,000 British soldiers.
Hello, Jen. Welcome to the show.
Hello, John.
We covered in our introduction that you are reporting from Calgary, which is in Canada. Am I right?
That is correct. Mm-hmm. Have you been to Calgary?
Oh, I have been. I've been to Calgary, you know, on a lot of cattle drives.
Uh-huh.
And also on helicopter ski trips, because I bring both worlds together.
I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. But you're not a native of Calgary, is that right?
I am not. I grew up in and spent most of my life in Ontario, and lived in Toronto for 16 years. But my family's out here, so I followed them.
Is it commonplace in Canada, as it is in the United States, to leave your home and move west, or to go from city to city, or are most people kind of rooted in their place?
I think it's a mix. Like, I grew up in small towns, and I think that I definitely know people who are still stayed pretty close to home, and then met a lot of people who, have moved around a lot. And I know in Ontario, people really like to go west, especially if people are big into skiing or snowboarding. There's a lot more opportunity to do that. So I knew people in, like, just after high school who came out here to, like, do firefighting. So because there's so much need for that. So, yeah, people move a fair bit. I mean, probably similarly to the States.
Yeah, but, you know, the United States has that ability to also move north and south, where Canada just feels like you can only go two directions, east and west.
I don't know too many people who, like, I know a couple people, like someone who lives in Nunavut, someone who lives in Yukon. Mm-hmm. I've not been to either of those places, although I would love to. I actually, one of the social circus stuff that I do, they often work in the Arctic. So I'm hoping one day to maybe be able to go up and do a program up there.
Oh, I think you'd have a blast. It's a whole different universe.
Right. Yeah. Cause you're familiar with that from Alaska.
I've been to Fort Yukon in Alaska, but I've also been up the Yukon to Dawson City and Whitehorse.
Oh, nice.
I mean, I don't know, but I think nice might be a little bit of an exaggeration, but it's definitely there.
We're sort of, you're right, it's a bit more of an east-west, although I actually still haven't, I've been to other places, I've been to Africa, I've been to Europe, I've been to New Zealand, and I've never been to Newfoundland.
All the Newfoundlanders are like rolling their eyes again.
I know. I'm sorry. Listen, Newfoundlanders, you are my favorite. Even though I've never been there, every single one of them I've ever met, they're my favorite. So.
Have you been to Prince Edward Island? Have you been to any of the Maritimes?
No, I've never gone any farther than Quebec.
Yeah, wow. Oh, not even to Quebec City?
No.
I've been
to Montreal.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to play this Canada game with you because... We have more to talk about than
than our
mutual geography. So
we do.
Where are we?
We are. Well, first, I'd like to know something.
Of course.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
What is your relationship to the common pigeon?
Well, you know, today, this very day, I was having a cookie out by the reservoir on Seattle's Capitol Hill, the Cal Anderson Park Reservoir. I was sitting on a park bench having a cookie with a friend. We each had a cookie. And there at the park, there's a fountain and a pond. And there were seagulls there, which are in Seattle. I mean, the seagulls are as big as dogs. Mm-hmm. And they can be extremely obnoxious because they, you know, they have that unique quality of seeming to have no brain, but also mm-hmm. they're very canny. How do you do that? How are you like super brainless and also like really like sly?
Yeah.
And then there were pigeons, and you know, seagulls and pigeons live side by side, but they don't acknowledge one another.
No.
But here we are with two giant oatmeal cookies, and both the seagulls and the pigeons are just ignoring us. And I said to my friend, what's going on with these birds? Normally, I would think both seagulls and pigeons would see us eating giant cookies, and they'd be all over us.
Exactly.
And my friend pointed to everyone else in the park, and he said, these are the laziest pigeons in the city. Everybody in this park is eating, and they're all dropping food, and there's dog kibble everywhere. And it's like, these pigeons don't have to work.
No, they're waiting for it to come to them.
Yeah. And yeah. Then these two pigeons were standing right in front of me. And then one of them puffed himself up, and I realized, oh, it's this whole game with the big boy pigeon doing the dur, 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 and then the gal pigeon being like, get off, get away. And then they did their little mating dance because it's spring.
Yep.
They did their mating dance for my amusement because my friend was telling some story and wasn't paying attention. But I always liked the little dance.
Yes.
Except I used to have pigeons living on the roof of the building next to me when I lived on Capitol Hill.
Yeah.
And they would do that freaking dance right outside my window at dawn. And I hated them.
Yes. It is very dependent on whatever interaction is happening with them at any given moment, I've found as well. I have similar, you know, the only time I really encountered them was when I lived in Toronto. They're usually in cities, right?
Yeah.
So generally, I never thought about pigeons unless there was a whole gaggle of them blocking the sidewalk and you're trying to navigate past them, or when we couldn't use a friend's balcony because it had been just plastered and pigeon poop, despite all manner of barbed wire fencing and fake plastic owls.
Well, they're natively a cliff-dwelling bird.
Yes.
And so, yeah, they take to skyscrapers and apartment buildings because they want their little nooks and crannies, right?
That's right. So, yeah, I had never really thought about them other than that until I decided I wanted to do some research into a story that I was told when I was about 13 for the first time.
Nerd.
I know, right? I'm in the right place, I think.
I decided to do some research about a thing that someone told me once.
To be fair, it was a story that had come up repeatedly over the years.
Oh, I see.
But the first time I heard it, I heard it from my grandmother when I was in, well, we would say grade 8 here. Mm-hmm. I suppose you guys would say 8th grade.
We would.
And we had an assignment to do, and we were supposed to interview a family member about an interesting story from our family's history. And so I had complained to my mom and said, our family is boring. Who am I going to interview and about what? And she said, call your oma, which is, they were Dutch, so it's Dutch for grandmother. Mm-hmm. So call your oma and ask her to tell you the story about the pigeon during the war.
The pigeon during the war.
Right. Intriguing. So I did. And so the story I'm going to tell you next is, I heard, that was the first time that I heard a version of it. And so my grandmother's family in you know, she was born in 1927.
Mm-hmm.
They lived on a farm in the southern Netherlands in a little village called Galder. It's actually probably the Dutch G is like huh, so it's probably like Galder.
Holder.
Galder. So I'm probably going to, I actually can speak German, but not Dutch. So I'm probably going to, any Dutch listeners, my apologies in advance. I'm probably going to butcher some names. But so her family, they're the Norens, lived on a 20-hectare farm in southern Netherlands. They were right at the border to Belgium. They used to go to church in Belgium. They were so close.
Did they have a windmill?
They didn't have a windmill. And I feel like now that you say that, they missed a chance there. They should have had a windmill.
Actually, you know, the more I think about it, a lot of the windmills are like public works.
True.
Right? You don't have one in your yard. They're municipal.
You don't need one. You don't need one in your stream or your pond, I guess.
Right.
So they had a pretty good, my great grandfather, his name was Henricus. He sold the milk from the dairy cattle on the farm. That was like its primary operation, but they also had pigs and chickens. They grew grass for feed. They grew beets, pretty big vegetable garden, fruit orchards. So they were pretty lucky after the Netherlands was invaded, during the Second World War because they had access to their own food.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, during the hunger winter, the famine in 44 to 45, they actually, because the South had been liberated first, they actually had people who were walking and bicycling down from Rotterdam and The Hague and looking for food. And so they fed a number of people on their farm.
I'm surprised to hear that the various armies didn't requisition the food. I would think that they would be in harm's way just because anybody that had food.
I was surprised by that as well. And I think the only time that the Germans were on the actual farm was right at the very end. They had occupied the farm and were staying. I think they were sleeping in the hay attic, the barn, and they were digging anti-tank trenches because it was right as the Allied forces were approaching.
Right.
And they were trying to slow them down, I guess. According to my great aunt, who is in this story, she said that they ended up abandoning that project because they realized that the Canadians were coming from the other direction.
That's right.
At a certain point.
That's how the Canadians do it.
Yeah, man. They look over there. Pay attention to the Americans. They're making noise over there.
Right. Well, it was the British played a big role in that series of battles. But then, you know, you think, here comes the British army. And it's like, nope, it's really the Canadians you have to worry about.
It's true.
Yeah.
So that was the only time that they had occupied their farm. So I think they were like doubly lucky in that because that is exactly what was happening to a lot of people. And it may have been that region just had a lot of food if it was all farms there. But so at that point, this particular story takes place probably early September 1944 or late August. My grandmother would have been about 17 and was the oldest at that time so far of 12 children, although she would eventually be the oldest of 14.
Wow.
Right? And one morning, my two of her younger sisters went outside to play, Ria and Yoka, who are 8 and 10. And or 10 and 8, actually. And Ria saw something lying on the ground in the orchard, something yellow.
This is in what month of 1944?
This would have been either late August or very early September.
Wow. Okay. So it's really going on.
We're like, yes.
Super happening right now.
That's right. There's lots of stuff going on, lots of places.
Yeah.
The girls are outside playing. They see something yellow lying in the orchard. They go over to check out what it is. They see that it's a parachute attached to a round tube-like container that has a little gap in it. And through the gap, they can see that there is something alive.
Don't.
So they run inside. They get my great-grandfather, and they tell him, there's a container in the field, and I think there's a chicken in it.
Well, you know, the Allies were very famous for dropping containers full of weasels. It was one of the main strategies, the Netherlands with weasels. And, you know, the weasels, of course, very intelligent animals. But it turns out they were dropping chickens.
Well, they thought it was a chicken. That's what from their brief glimpse of what they saw, they thought, someone's dropping chickens.
Sure. It makes perfect sense.
Totally.
To a 10-year-old.
They were 8 and 10. he brings it inside. He tells them, you tell nobody about this, not even the other siblings. It opens it up. And inside is a pigeon with a letter in English, with a 1 pound bag of food. Okay. The bird.
Oh, bird food. Okay.
Bird food. Yeah. I know, not for the people.
Okay. But,
and a little carton to it. Or sorry, not a carton, but a little cartridge or canister to attach to the bird's leg.
Right.
And some little pieces of paper. So at the time, nobody in their family could speak English. So they brought it to my great grandfather brought it to the local head teacher at the school,
right,
who could, and had him translate it. And it was a letter from the British Army asking for intel on where the locations of the Germans and their activities in the area. So they decided they were going to respond. And they filled out a couple of names of places that were in pretty close proximity to their farm. So one of them was a radar station called Biesemstelle. And it had two of the Würzburg radars and a Freya long range radar. And then very nearby that was the Hilzerayen Air Base, which the Germans had commandeered when they'd occupied the Netherlands and had built up. And that was one of the main locations, I think, that a lot of the night fighters were stationed and leaving from through the course of the war.
I had no idea that this was any kind of, I've never heard of this operation, you know, all of this stuff, the bridge too far, like there's so many stories, mythologies of this time. But the idea that that the British were just like, I bet a certain percentage of the people in the Netherlands are gonna either find this intriguing or, you know, are enough of a rule following culture that they'll be like, well, this seems like
right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm definitely not as so. There's going to be lots of gaps probably that you'll be able to fill in. I'm up until I started looking into this particular story. I mean, I know the basic shape of the events that took place during World War II. Obviously, I know the awful Holocaust stories and things like that, right? But I had never really been super into war history.
Right.
But
you can be forgiven for that.
Thank you. Well, I'm starting to be now. This is my gateway drug, apparently, was pigeons.
Okay. I like it.
But I was still surprised. I was like, how did I get this far and not know any of this? Like, why is this not more well known? So so they had the radar station, the airbase. They were using those radars, so they used the Würzburg, I think, to guide the night fighters. They would each target one of the planes, and then the Freya was for like the longer distance planes coming on bombing raids. So they wrote both of those locations down. They fed the bird as per the instructions, and then they released him. And several weeks later, again, because I don't know the exact date of the event of the pigeon, but based on everything, what we do know is that on October 2nd, both of those locations were bombed by the Allies.
Wow.
And 2 days after, so October 4th of 44, the Germans totally destroyed what was left of the Biesemstelle radar station and fled because it wasn't much longer after that I think Galder was liberated on the 29th
right.
of October.
Right.
So and you know, it's kind of cool because now I always forget how this works. My mom's cousin. So I think that means first cousin once removed.
Yes.
Is that how? That's it, right?
Yes.
I always mix it up. So my first cousin once removed, Anne-Marie, we were chatting and she lives near there, only about 10 minutes from the airbase. And her son actually is part of the Dutch Air Force and works there. So our family still has a connection. And Anne-Marie is the daughter of Joke, was one of the girls who found the pigeon. So we've been connecting and chatting about this.
And is she as interested in it as I would be if my parent had played a part in this raid?
I almost think that because they've heard this story their whole lives, and they, you know, so Yoka has a certificate. We'll get to that in a second.
Certificate.
So they've seen that and they know that. So I think, yeah, I don't know that they, I'm not sure how much they've thought of it.
Like, you could almost walk over there.
Yeah.
And look around the perimeter and find like bomb craters, you know, and or just like,
right?
Yeah, plant a little flag like this bomb quarter, you know, hole is from my dad.
Right. Which is really cool. I mean, and the farmhouse is still there. That farmhouse that they lived in was built in the mid 1600s. And they my parents
still live in it?
No, so they left. They immigrated to Canada eventually. So someone else lives there now. But my parents went traveled there last year to see the old homestead and get a photo, so which is pretty cool.
And have you been?
I have not been. So I've been to the Netherlands, but not there. I did a semester of school in Germany in high school. And so that's where I learned to speak German. And we would go across the border and go shopping in the Netherlands. And I went to Amsterdam, but I didn't get a chance at that point to make it to where my family is. So it's kind of my next, hopefully, trip.
Where did you go to high school?
In a small town in Ontario.
No. I mean in Germany.
Oh, I was like,
where did you go?
I was like, we're just going to change topics completely. in Germany, it was in it was near Dusseldorf, about an hour outside of Dusseldorf, mm-hmm. in Nordrhein-Westfalia. So the northwest.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so, you know, the Netherlands, like, I don't know if you've ever, if you've listened to the Omnibus,
I have.
It may have come up once or twice that I once walked across the Netherlands.
And what did it take you? Where did it take you through?
So I landed there at Hoek van Holland, okay. Which is, you know, down in the south.
Yeah.
And then I walked straight up the beach. For 3 days.
Oh, wow.
Before turning right and walking over to Amsterdam.
Okay.
And walking on the beach there, it was a very bad idea because walking on the beach is hard. And at one point I was like, I'm going to walk in the water. And then my boots filled up with salt water and basically my feet just came completely apart. But one of the amazing things that I didn't know, and I'd been to the Netherlands, you know, a handful of times before that, I didn't realize that the entire nation had been turned into a fortified, like, it was just a giant, like, wall of bunkers and tank traps. I mean, the entire coast. And it was like, and it's all still there, you know, in states of decay. But it made the war so much realer. And of course, that wasn't where the Allies landed or invaded. All of that stuff was just a waste of cement. Or, I mean, maybe not. Maybe it scared the British enough that they were like, let's go invade in France. But, but yeah, the war is very still, it's very apparent there. If you look for it, it wouldn't be, you know, if you just were wandering. I mean, I guess if you were in Rotterdam, you'd say, why aren't there any old buildings in Rotterdam?
Right. Yeah. I had that experience when I went to Berlin last year. I had been to Germany a few times, but had still never been to Berlin. And so the last time I went, I was like, this is happening. And I felt it there more than necessarily in some other places where, I mean, you can still see remnants of the wall. You can still see, you know, where they patched up the Brandenburg Gate, right? Like all the, there's more signs of it there than there are in some other places.
Yeah, right. And I mean, of course, whole neighborhoods, block after block, that were all
gone.
Built in 1950
That's
or
right.
yeah 1955 yeah,
exactly,
which as we know was the peak period for apartment building architecture.
That's right. Brutalism.
Hey, we're back
first
to brutalism.
Yes.
Hey, it's Manager Grant. How are you? How are you, Grant?
I'm good, John. How about you?
I'm really good. Thanks for coming over here to talk to me about Smalls cat food.
I'm happy to be here.
You have cats.
I have two cats.
What are your cats' names?
Mimi and Bruno.
Oh. We're just having a little cuddly time.
Yeah.
And are your cats good cats?
Very good cats.
Are they really?
They are.
Both are good cats.
One is the example of a scaredy cat, and one is the example of curiosity killed the cat. So one is very, one will run away when anybody comes. The other one is, you know, eating all the plants in the house and knocking things over.
Right. We have one cat whose name is Alyeska.
Mm.
And Alyeska is a very, very difficult cat to like.
Mm-hmm.
The cat itself is not difficult. It doesn't appear to have any difficulties, but it's very difficult to like.
Yeah.
And one of the problems, of course, is that the cat is a barfer.
Hairballs?
Well, no. It's like a scarf the food and then barf the food. I hope no one is listening to the program and
eating
cat food as we talk. But yeah, it's been quite a trick to interact with this cat in a way that benefits the human beings.
Right.
What do you feed your cat?
You know, a combination of wet food and dry food.
Mm-hmm. That seems to be the way.
Yeah.
You know, I think every cat owner knows that unlike dogs are omnivores, but cats do not want to eat fruit and grain.
No.
They are carnivores through and through. And I think a lot of the food we end up serving cats doesn't serve them.
Yeah. No, I agree.
Yeah. And that is why we're here, you and I, to inform futurelings about Smalls. Smalls is protein-packed, lightly cooked, gently cooked cat food, free from preservatives, 100% human-grade ingredients.
Sounds good.
And I think that's actually a way of describing food. Is this human-grade?
Yeah.
And this is human-grade, which is I can't say about all of my food.
I certainly can't.
Yeah, right. And so this is all food, real food. And I think a primary advantage is this is delivered right to your door.
How convenient.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Can you imagine not having to go at 1 o'clock in the morning, as I so often am at the grocery store, trying to sort through all these different cans, looking for any of them to say human grade on them?
None of them do.
None of them do. So Smalls was ranked by Forbes as the best overall cat food. It's received plaudits from BuzzFeed, which, as you and I know, it's basically like being in the Encyclopedia Britannica. And over 88% of cat owners who have tried Smalls reported overall health improvements. But you can try, Grant.
I'm going to.
Yeah, you can try Smalls risk-free. They'll refund your money if your cat won't eat their food.
I'm all in.
So I want you and all futurelings to stop serving your little carnivore a bowl of processed shortcuts.
All right,
I will. You know, when you say shortcut, you're actually talking about it's like a butcher term.
Really?
Yeah, for the cuts that are from the short end.
I had no idea.
I might be making that up. For a limited time, because you are an Omnibus futureling, get 60% off your first order plus free shipping and free treats for life when you head to smalls.com/omnibus! That's 60% off your first order plus free shipping, free treats for life when you head to smalls.com/omnibus! Don't forget to put the exclamation point in there. That's how you're going to get the free deals.
Let's go back to the Netherlands. After the war, the BBC put the call out throughout Europe that requesting people who had participated in sending intelligence through pigeons, that they identify themselves so that the UK could recognize them and thank them. My great-grandfather, Henricus, unfortunately, had died in January of 46. He was severely injured in a farm accident.
Oh.
So that was terrible. somebody, I don't know who, I don't know if it was a family member or a neighbor, or it could have even been the head teacher who had helped him in the translation, did submit his name though, knowing what had happened by that point. And so he was awarded a posthumous certificate of merit from the War Office in London. And it says, Certificate of Merit awarded on behalf of His Britannic Majesty's Government in the United Kingdom to the late Mr. H.C. Noren, the courageous actions of those living under enemy occupation who assisted in forwarding information about the enemy by carrier pigeon to His Majesty's Armed Forces in the United Kingdom. And so that certificate, my great aunt, Yoka, who turns 90 this year, I believe, has that in the Netherlands with her.
Now, it does make you think, like, if that had happened, if my kids had come running in and said, there's a chicken in a barrel, and I'd opened it up and taken the note to the local teacher and read it, I don't know how much I would have considered the possibility that the Germans were so diabolical that this would be a way of rooting out traitors.
Yep.
And that I would hesitate to... You know, this is how they get you, right?
Yep. And as we'll see later, that was definitely some people's reactions. And the Germans definitely gave that a go on a couple of occasions as well.
Played it up even.
Yes. So that would have been a good instinct. And what I mean, it speaks to like the risk for sure that people were taking, that regular citizens would be taking by participating, which is in that moment a big decision to make. And I've thought about that too. I thought this is a man who had 12 children at that point in time. And, you know, things are getting real around them everywhere, and still thought, you know what? No, let's like, we're going to help.
Yeah, right. Like, I guess by August or September of 1944, the writing was a little bit more on the wall.
I believe that as well. People knew that people were experiencing hope, I think, in a different way, and the relief and knowing that it was coming, that it was much more inevitable at that point than it had ever been up until that point. So that would have probably made it an easier decision as well.
So let me ask, it seems to me that if a pigeon came into my life in this way, mm-hmm. and the pigeon played, you know, a fairly large role in defeating the Germans and liberating my town. And then let's say, for instance, you know, my father died in a farming accident. I would still like feel like I should make the pigeon maybe the emblem on my family crest, or maybe that I would become a pigeoneer myself. Like, did they start keeping pigeons? Was there any kind of like a pigeon on the top of their Christmas tree? Did pigeons become an emblem?
So I did never see them as an emblem, but what I can tell you is that they did have a pigeon loft.
They did.
After my grandmother did. So my grandparents came to Canada in 1949. At that point, there was no housing. There was no, like, things were not great. A lot of people were immigrating from the Netherlands to Canada and other places. So they initially came. And I mean, they actually started, I think, in northern Quebec somewhere. So, but they eventually made their way to southern Ontario. And yeah, they had some land there, a barn, big garden, vegetable garden. And my mom said when she was young, they had a pigeon. They had pigeons, kept pigeons as well. I don't know that they were sending messages with them.
Well, people also eat them. They are the chickens of the sky.
It's true. So yeah, but I don't remember them. And I don't recall, you know, seeing any pigeons around. But I had originally heard that story for the first time as a teenager. And then in 2018, a Dutch article from a newspaper started circulating my family. My uncle sent it to us, and it was an interview with Yoka about this particular story. Oh. And it had some of those more details in it, like the radar station and things like that, that I either didn't remember, hadn't known. And that was when I kind of went, okay, how have I gotten this far in my life without knowing anything else about pigeons and the war? Like, I know this isolated story, but it obviously is embedded in something bigger than that. So I went looking for some information, and there wasn't a lot.
It does feel like the plot of a Wes Anderson movie, or it feels like something that should have been by now documented in a hilarious war pic.
Of course.
Right.
Right. So what I did find, and so I'm going to shout out the author of a book called, let me just grab the book here, Operation Columba, The Secret Pigeon Service. Mm-hmm. By Gordon Carrera. So Carrera is a former BBC security consultant. Mm-hmm. And he got interested. In his intro, he talks about how he found his way to becoming the expert on this topic. And it's because I think it might have been during the 80s in London, someone was renovating a building and they took apart the chimney and they found pigeon bones. And attached to one of the leg bones was still a canister that had a coded message in it that I think still nobody has decoded.
Whoa.
So that was, and he was covering that story and he was like, okay, we need to talk about pigeons during the war. So he went and found the declassified military intelligence file for Operation Columba. And he did an amazing amount of research. So not only did he go through all of the intelligence files and stuff, he went to Belgium and did a bunch of research in Belgium. And he also tracked down the families of a couple of men who will be some of our heroes further on in this story, and got a treasure trove of information from them. So almost all of the information that I was able to track down really comes from his book. So I wanted to shout him out. And also he has a podcast as well. He co-hosts a podcast called The Rest is Classified about military intelligence.
Oh, that sounds cool.
So I listened to a couple episodes. It's pretty cool. So,
and what year did the book come out?
The book came out the same year as the newspaper article about my great aunt. So in 2018.
And it's too bad that that's just after he had any likelihood of interviewing any like people that were grown up during the war.
Exactly.
But marvelous that there were still people that were kids.
Yep. And the families of some of the people had very like carefully held on to some really precious stuff that had survived. Mm-hmm. So he includes photos and stuff in the book, which is very cool. So I wanted to just make sure that I properly cite your sources and recommend it if anyone's interested, because that was where I got the story. But yeah, so I went all the way back to the beginning. I was like, okay, what's the deal with these pigeons?
Mm-hmm. Was this a World War One thing, or does this go back to the Crimean War, or does this go back to 1550?
What would be your guess as to when we first started using pigeons to send messages?
I mean, it almost feels like a Roman Empire thing.
Close.
Really?
Farther.
Was it the Greeks? Was it before the Greeks?
Farther.
Was it Byzantium?
It was the first proof we have, so it very well could have been before. The first proof is from Akhenaten's rule in ancient Egypt.
Wow, Egyptian pigeonry.
Yeah. There's bas-reliefs from his reign that show people releasing pigeons from cages carrying messages.
I think so, that's also where the weasel drop was invented.
It almost certainly.
The Egyptians were so good at animal husbandry.
Way ahead of their time. Yeah. So they, and the birds they would have used would be pretty similar probably to what we used, to the birds that are used for pigeon racing and stuff today. There are members of the rock dove family, which I think sounds way cooler than pigeon. And I don't know why we don't call them rock doves.
I like rock dove too.
Right?
Yeah, rock dove.
I think that's a missed opportunity there. Maybe we can make it happen if we just start calling them rock doves.
I want to know what the derivation of the word pigeon, like where it comes from. And it's French, of course.
Of course.
They ruin everything. Rock dove.
Rock doves. Yeah. So the rock dove, or the domesticated pigeon, is the domesticated version of a species that called Columba livia.
Oh.
Hence the name of our operation. People use a lot of names for them interchangeably. So carrier pigeon, racing pigeon, homing pigeon essentially all mean the same. People are referring to the same domesticated bird that's been bred specifically for their speed and for their ability to home. So their ability to find their way back to their home loft.
But these pigeons do differ from street pigeons and like prison pigeons and all the pigeons that we normally see.
I don't know if genetically they would be a ton different. I mean, the same species.
Right, of course.
But they would be, a little bit different genetically.
It's like the difference between having a pet rat that crawls on you and licks your face and then the rats in the walls.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah. I think that's what the difference is. So I think at this point, all the birds that would have been used in the 19th and 20th century and up probably till today would be of a breed called Racing Homer, mm-hmm. which just makes me think of The Simpsons, mm-hmm. but I guess that's the most common breed.
I think that calling someone a Homer, at least for my generation, it was like calling someone a loser or a dork, like, what a right? Homer. I think that's why Homer Simpson's name is so funny to people of a certain age.
Fair, totally fair.
What a Homer.
Yeah, I kind of have the same reaction to it. And I consider myself honorary Gen X.
Oh, are you a cusp? Are you a?
I am the eldest of the elder millennials.
Right on. Well, we definitely high five the elder millennials around here. Yeah.
Perfect. So, in terms of how they do what they do, from what I can see, seems like there's a lot of hypotheses and theories. And the general consensus is like, it's a combination of lots of things that we're not 100% sure about.
Right.
So they use a bunch of, it appears they use a bunch of different environmental cues.
It's not the magnetic field. That was popular.
That's probably one, if not the main thing.
Okay.
I think there was recent research that showed that there's brainstem cells that are associated with their inner ear. If you expose them to a magnetic field, it activates them.
Oh, wow.
So they think that they might be actually able to use those cell signals as like a GPS, which is kind of badass.
But they also are like just following the roads and like looking for a particular mailbox?
So the closer they get to home, they're also likely using olfactory and visual cues. They're also using the sun direction and their own internal clock, because they've done studies where if you mess their internal clock up and then put them out into sun that isn't where it should be based on how their original clock was, they will be disoriented. Hmm. They're obviously not solely navigating on the sun, because they can do it at night and they can do it in bad weather. But they think it's a mix of all of those things, that there might be a photoreceptor in pigeons' eyes that contribute to certain things. So it's kind of a magic trick.
I mean, this is astonishing given that their brain is the size of a pencil eraser.
Right?
You don't think interacting with them on the streets, like, oh, this little creature's got something going on behind those eyes.
No, when they like won't get out of your way and they're just sort of all milling confusedly on the sidewalk.
Like, hey, dingbat, move it on.
To be fair, I've not met any of the ones living in racing lofts. Perhaps they're a little different.
Right. Yeah. You do meet, rats where you're like, huh? Yeah, I get it. Like, right? It's a nice rat, yeah. I guess.
There's a range.
Yeah. People keep lizards and describe like whole personalities to lizards.
I do find that harder.
And I'm like, I don't know. Are you sure that lizard loves you? Can lizards love?
One can only hope.
I think rats can.
I do. I used to keep rats. Oh, I had rats as pets. Yeah. Before I graduated to dogs, I felt like my responsibility threshold was like set right about rats.
Yeah.
But I'm desperately allergic to them.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah. So it was not ideal. But yeah, they're very, very smart.
And do you feel like rats can love?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I do believe that they form bonds with each other. Because I know that if one of mine died, the others definitely had reactions to it and appeared to be exhibiting sadness type behaviors that, you know, I'm not, I don't mind anthropomorphizing animals a little bit. I don't think it does us any harm to do that. And it definitely helps them.
Agreed. Agreed. Okay. So let's assume that a pigeon probably can't, let's just say, I'm not going to say that a pigeon can't love, but let's table whether or not a pigeon can love, but we do think that a pigeon has a sophisticated capacity to navigate that isn't just that it's following some single beacon.
Yes, it appears to be multiple inputs that they're relying on a combination of. So, and as we said, they used them, we know for certain they used them in ancient Egypt. They used them in ancient Greece for the Olympics. They, athletes would bring them from their home villages so that they could release them with news of their hopeful victory. I believe Mark Antony used them in a particular battle in northern Italy. There was a massive pigeon post network in the Persian Empire.
I think I knew that.
Yeah, Cyrus the Great had about 100,000 pigeon birds. And there was also later on, I think, a Muslim ruler called Sultan Nur al-Din in Syria. He had a pretty elaborate pigeon mail service. They had like every 7 miles or something, they had lofts. And that ran until probably close to like 1500 AD.
Well, so this feels like an undertold story of all of history.
Right?
Like how many things happened in ancient times where we're like, well, then that happened. But at the heart of it, there was the story of one noble pigeon.
Right? I know. I got bogged down in that. I'm not going to lie. There was so many. Like, so, because then, I mean, the 19th century actually sees it as the emergence of it as a sport. So now we're racing pigeons.
Right.
Now people are keeping lofts and breeding them very specifically to race. And it started in Belgium and then spread out from there to the rest of Europe. By the late 1800s, there was 150 racing societies in Belgium, and even Queen Victoria and the British aristocracy were keeping pigeons. The guy who founded Reuters, Paul Reuters, the guy who created that news agency, he employed a fleet of 45 pigeons. So there was a gap for a while in the telegraph cable between Aachen and Brussels. And he used pigeons to bridge that gap because it gave him a leg up from using the regular post because he could get the like stock exchange information faster if he sent it if it was sent by pigeon.
It seems to me, not knowing everything, but it seems like between Aachen and Brussels would not be the place that there was like a, of all the places where, oh no, the telegraph lines, it feels like it's not that steep or, you know, it's pretty flat. Like you could.
It's only 76 kilometers.
Yeah, not really far. So I wonder what was going on there, but it's interesting that pigeons and telegraphs were still like working together in concert as a network.
Yes. During the, we're about to get to the actual war that is the topic of today's show. But they were also used during the siege of Paris during the Franco-Prussian war. So it was the only way that the people in besieged Paris could get messages out. But of course, pigeons return home. So they had to get the birds out. So they would fly them out attached to balloons. And then people would find them and then send messages back, and then they would send messages out with the pigeons attached to balloons. And that was actually, it was the Franco-Prussian War, it was Prussia at the time, but it's believed that the Germans learned a lot about pigeons and using them during war from that experience that they later used in subsequent wars.
It does feel like you have to have a lot of pigeons. That's like a message in a bottle kind of scenario.
100%.
You have to throw 1,000 pigeons tied to balloons out there to get what was the rate of return?
I don't know the rate of return for the Franco-Prussian War. I can tell you that the rate of return for Operation Columba itself during World War II was about 1 in 10. That's
still
not bad, actually.
Oh, 10%, that's pretty amazing.
Not bad. And so we make it to the 20th century. It was pretty big in the UK. It was a big working class hobby and sport. You know, you can know it's not a race. Racing horses is not an easy world to get into, but pigeons was like an accessible, you know, you could have a loft, you could be a part of it. They would load up the pigeons, train them, load them up on truck, drive them all off somewhere, release them all, and then time the birds, and whoever's bird made it home first would be the winner. So it was a big, big popular sport.
It does feel like a film trope that when two young gangsters want to talk to the old wise gangster, they have to go up to the roof of a tenement building where the old gangster is retired and is just keeping pigeons in a like stapled together pigeon loft up there, right?
Totally. Yep. So they bred about 100,000 of them during World War I to use as carrier pigeons. And they were used with good success on the French and Italian fronts. Primarily, they were used for communicating short distances across the front lines. So they had mobile lofts, so the birds could be trained to home to a mobile loft as opposed to their, you know, a stationary loft somewhere. So that was often how they would do that. And they were really useful if, you know, cables had been damaged by bombing or had been cut deliberately, or if visibility for signaling, other types of signaling, was poor. So they were put to pretty good use during World War I. At the end of the war, they actually disbanded the British Army Pigeon Service.
Oh, that was a mistake.
Big mistake, turns out. And there were people at the time in Britain who thought so. And so they put some pressure on the Committee on Imperial Defense. In about 1938, they responded to some of the pressure from the pigeon fancy world, who were sort of saying, like, you guys need a plan. You know, I think the writing was starting to be on the wall and people knew that they had been useful. So the Committee on Imperial Defense created another committee, because bureaucracy.
That's right.
And, to create the National Pigeon Service, which was going to be a volunteer civilian organization of pigeon fanciers and pigeon owners.
Right, of course, and conscientious objectors, right, animal lovers.
Yep.
I now I'm wondering, if you were a spy or a commando, was part of your kit that we never hear about, like two pigeons tucked into your tunic?
I will get to that.
Okay. I just looked up that the average incubation period for a pigeon egg is 18 days.
Yeah.
Because how are you going to breed 100,000 pigeons? Well, you just get them going. And
they were, yeah, they were, there's a pigeon who, I will, we'll get to at the end, that I'm going to mention specifically. And he, was bred in Algiers. Mm-hmm. So they had lofts, so they were breeding them at the front. So we get our National Pigeon Service. That's step one. And we've got people signing up from Britain. And they, as the war begins, so in September 1939, after Germany invaded Poland, they kind of tighten up the rules. At this point now, you need to register, everybody needs to register their birds. Any birds that are found without a ring to identify their owner are going to be destroyed.
Ooh.
And really early on, about 2,000 lofts were signed up to participate in war effort stuff. By the end, I think it would be about 18,000 lofts.
Whoa.
And I think the total in England at the time was like 70,000, which seems like a lot of people owning pigeons.
That's just a lot of roof space, 70,000 pigeon lofts.
Lot. So they give the role of supervising this civilian organization to the British Air Ministry, which between, I believe, 1918 and 1946 is the government department responsible for supervising the RAF and civilian aviation. So the Air Ministry is going to oversee the National Pigeon Service. They create the pigeon section of that, and that's who's going to be running this.
I just looked this up, and I'm not saying that this is definitive in any way, but there are only 42,000 buildings in London. So for there to be 70,000 pigeon lofts.
Oh, this is throughout all of the UK.
Right. But even so, that's like twice as many lofts as all of the buildings in London.
Which is a crazy amount.
That's a lot. They had to have been eating some of these pigeons.
It's almost certain at various points in time. Yeah. You have to assume, right? So there's, as the war is getting going, there's basically two worlds of pigeons, sort of two parallel tracks of pigeon use during the war. So we've got the ones we already talked about, which is using them for communication between active troops.
Right.
To get back, you know, communicating back to the front line. RAF soldier, or sorry, RAF pilots were taking them as well. If your plane gets shot down and you make it, but you have no way of telling anyone where you are, having a pigeon in with you could be super useful.
Right.
So they were definitely used for that, but there was value. It was felt by certain people that there would be value in using them for actual military intelligence collection.
Right.
And so one of the big proponents of that was somebody named Rex Pearson. So this was someone who had been involved with MI6 earlier on. He had worked with pigeons during World War I. At the end of that war, he was involved on the front lines in France with sending pigeons also by balloon, so similar to the Franco-Prussian War. So you're limited what direction they're going. But they would send those behind the line, the front lines in France, for citizens with questionnaire that said, hey, where are the Germans? What are they doing? And they'd had some success with that. So he kind of moved around. He left England for a while, goes to Switzerland, ends up being recruited back by into MI6, and he goes to the War Office and says, like, hey, we did this thing during World War I. I think we can expand that and try something. Like, what if we, like, that, but bigger?
Right. I'm your pigeon guy.
Yeah. So his suggestion was, is can we find out if how far they'll come? Like, do we even know? Does anyone know how far they'll home from? And can we drop them in from planes in the occupied territory?
This wasn't something that they knew in the ancient world. Like some gladiator didn't go all the way to Vladivostok and let go a pigeon.
Somebody must. And I don't know if there's like a record or something. I feel like I should have looked up whether Guinness Book of World Record has a record pigeon. For the longest pigeon flight. Maybe you could look that
That's
up.
That's what I'm here for.
Perfect.
Grant, thank you for joining me today. I wanted to tell you a little bit about Hims. Are you familiar with Hims?
I am familiar with the Hims company.
Tell me about your middle-aged hair journey.
Well, you know, to be honest, I used to, as a young man, they would always go to the barber and they would thin my hair out because it was so thick.
But yeah.
They stopped doing that a few years ago.
They haven't recommended thickening it out?
No, well, not yet, but I'm guessing I'm en route.
I had a similar problem, and strangely enough, the hair, this is what barbers have told me.
Right.
The hairs themselves are thin. But I had so much of it that it was like it was too thick to deal with, right? So same type of thing. They needed to thin it first. Mm-hmm. But the hairs are thin, so I'd never had that Jim Morrison big hair. Mm-hmm. It was always just lots of thin hair, like straw. But as you say, now I don't need to have my hair thin.
Don't tell you anymore.
No, it's thinning. It's thinning just fine on its own. And I think I'm across the threshold where, I don't know, you've known me for many years. You've known me for 20 years.
20 plus.
What have you noticed? What are the differences in your perception of, like, the fullness of my hair?
Well, you know, I remember you in the wild, wild long hair days.
Right.
And so, I mean, mostly the shortening of it, but
hair down into the middle of my back.
Yeah. I mean, it's like anybody, you get a certain age and it's like, you know, not quite as luscious and amazing as it used to be.
And do you feel like, what about my vanity as a public performer? Do you feel like I'm at the point where I should be using some kind of prescription creams or
It's really
foams?
Up to you, John. I have
I know. I know, but you know, as the manager, you're trying to sell me to the world.
Thicker hair.
Yeah. Okay, good. Good.
You push me. Yes.
Thicker hair. Well, I love to talk about Hims because Hims provides doctor-trusted ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil that would potentially stop my further hair loss, regrow hair in as little as 3 to 6 months, and make me a more marketable celebrity.
I love that.
I want celebrity hair.
Yeah.
None of us should have to go out of our way to feel like ourselves, and Hims brings expert care straight to us with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put our goals for looking super foxy first. You know, it was just the Met Gala the other day,
yeah.
And I feel like still not invited this year.
But maybe if you get thicker hair.
Maybe next year, right? And I can dress like a swan or like a UFO. Right. Or maybe I'll just wear my hair. Maybe I'll just comb it down like Lady Godiva, and that'll be my Met Gala outfit.
Love it.
So for all of us futurelings who are trying to get invited to fancy parties, who want simple online access to personalized and affordable care for hair loss, for ED, for weight loss, and more, visit hims.com/omnibus. That's hims.com/omnibus for your free online visit. Get fancy, get hairy with me, a guy who wears his hair as part of his, you know, yeah, right.
Right.
Part of his overall super vibe. Go to hims.com/omnibus. Featured products include compounded drug products, which the FDA does not approve or verify for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information. Individual results may vary based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride.
He brings this idea to the war, to military intelligence in the war office. Now, MI6, who I believe they're separate from that, like they're the foreign office, they were not keen on pigeons at all. They thought pigeons were outdated, outmoded, not, you know, this is the war of technology, right? Like, we're done with pigeons. So MI6 were very sneering about pigeons through most of the war. And they actually come out not looking super great in this story. So Pearson's successful at convincing the war office that this might be a good idea. Let's give it a try. So they bring him on board to make him the officer in charge of the Special Continental Section of the Army Pigeon Service. So now we've got the MPS being supervised, the civilian organization being supervised by the Air Ministry. We've got the Army Pigeon Service up and running. And the war office decides they need to assign that to a military intelligence department. And so what they do is they assign it to MI-14. Are you familiar with that particular department during the war?
That sounds made up. I have never heard of MI-14. What's going on? You're telling me a lot of things here.
So MI-14 was created specifically during World War II to be an intelligence department just gathering intelligence on Germany, and even more specifically, like, the deployment of troops in Western Europe and their secret service work. So they were sort of very niche German, that all the officers who worked or agents who worked in it spoke German. At the beginning of the war, there were 5 whole people who worked for it. They had an office in the bowels of the war office.
How many partial people worked for them?
That remains to be seen. So 5 people worked for them. By the end, they would be approximately 50 people working in that department, but they started out pretty small. And so they decided the home for Operation Columba would be in MI-14D, and that was run by 2 guys, a man named Brian Melland and a man named Sandy Sanderson.
Come on.
I know. His name's like LHF Sanderson, and his nickname was Sandy. So Sandy Sanderson, Brian Melland, their job was to be, yeah, primarily at this point, because everything in Europe had fallen so quickly, they were like, when's England next? Like, their main goal was trying to determine if there was going to be an invasion of England and how imminent it was going to be.
Right.
And that's what these 2 guys have been working on. One of the challenges for them was that they had very little intelligence to evaluate. So the British intelligence network in Western Europe at that time, I guess, was not very robust.
Right. How could they have seen this coming?
Right. Nobody knew. So because the occupied countries had fallen so quickly, they hadn't had time to move agents in or set up networks like ways to run information through underground networks. And MI6's networks that they were relying on were essentially a mess. They'd had two agents at Venlo in 1939 were captured and interrogated. And at that point, they kind of just assumed our whole network's been compromised. So Sanderson and Melland were working with, they were getting intelligence from MI6 to about Germany to evaluate. And they were pretty skeptical of most of it. They actually, he would review hundreds of reports from agents in occupied territory, supposedly. But in he's quoted in Carrera's book as describing the majority of them as quite ludicrous. And saying that there wasn't a single successful source in France to report anything until November of 1940. There was supposedly also an agent in Belgium, but Sanderson described him as the least reliable of our whole body of sources.
Right.
So
that can that continues to be true of Belgians to this day.
Ooh, John, say it what no one else will say. And then the other issue with human intelligence, like with agents on the ground, was just the sheer length of time it took to get back to England. Mm-hmm. So at that point, especially because of the difficulty of moving in and out of the occupied territory, there was, I think the average was 4 months for a piece of intel to get back, which could, in many cases, it's a useless or potentially useless, right?
Yeah.
So, so this was going to, they were pretty pleased about Operation Columba. This was going to be their own intelligence that they would evaluate. So the messages would come back to them. Rex Pearson is the logistics guy. He's going to organize the collecting of the pigeons. They work out the logistics of how that's going to work. So the way they did that was they took the civilian volunteer lofts and they divided each local area into a pigeon supply group. And then they assigned one guy as a pigeon supply officer, and that would be their liaison with London. And so when they needed birds, Rex Pearson would be in charge of making sure that a van would come the day before a drop. People would be told, we need goods tonight. They'd send whichever birds they were going to send. They'd be loaded up in their baskets, taken back to London, and then delivered to the airfield. And they tried to make sure that they picked birds. So if they were going to be dropping in France, they would pick birds along the south coast. And if they were going to be dropping birds in Denmark or the Netherlands or Belgium, they would pick birds from like Ipswich, like along the eastern.
Yeah.
Eastern
coast. Not realizing that these birds could fly to Vietnam.
Correct.
They were like, no, we should give them a fighting chance here.
Yes. Yeah. So they, so while they're getting all that set up, then they do some, at this point we're at the end of 1940, they do some test runs, some pigeon drops. They want to work out like what kind of container is the safest to drop from an airplane where we don't hurt the birds or they have the best chance, you know, head up, head down, like what's the best way. They work out the logistics for the container. They decide, okay, they'll each be in their own. They'll be attached to a 3.5-foot parachute. And on the container, they attached an envelope and a questionnaire, rice paper and pencil for the return message, a bag containing food, and a canister for the message. And initially, they would translate the questionnaires into French or Dutch, depending on the drop site. I find that interesting because part of my grandparents' or my grandmother's family story was that it was in English. So yeah. I don't know if that changed over time or if maybe when they were just doing scattered drops, they just like, we're just going to throw out all the languages and hope some of them catch. By that point, the Allies were also in the territory. So it might make sense that if they thought an American or like, who knows?
Yeah. I mean, they may have just been like 30 miles away.
Right.
It might not have flown all the way back to England. It might have been just somebody scrawling it on a piece of paper.
True. Yeah. True. So they, and then the questionnaires listed all the types of information that they wanted. So basically and they ranked it in order of priority. So at the top of the list was any info about a planned invasion of England, details of the troops in the area, any addresses the Germans are using, what's the enemy morale, any airfield locations, the effect of any recent British bombing raids, and I thought this was interesting, but how well could they hear the BBC broadcasts?
Mm-hmm.
And so because the Germans had been trying to jam some of their broadcast signals and stuff like that, and they wanted to use the BBC as part of this project, they were also trying to ascertain, like, okay, can people actually access it?
Right.
So they end their questionnaire with the lines, "Thank you, take courage, we will not forget you." And then they include a little instruction sheet on how you properly attach the small green cylinder to the bird's leg.
Uh-huh.
And they would usually also include, like, the latest edition of a Dutch, French, or Belgian resistance newspaper.
Oh.
To kind of try, the idea being to reassure them that it was actually coming from England.
Yeah, right. I guess. Yeah, sure. That would reassure me.
It would help a little, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you could, if you could believe that Germans, that they got their hands on a bird, you guys, suppose you could also believe that they got their hands on a newspaper, but, and they decided that the way they would run it is that they would have RAF pilots on existing runs make the drops.
Oh, so the Germans aren't like, why are the Allies suddenly dropping chickens?
Yes.
Yeah.
So April 8th, 1941, they're ready to go. And RAF Whitley leaves from Newmarket for Belgium on the first run. The plane comes under a fair bit of anti-aircraft fire, but makes it and is able to push the birds out. And 2 days later, April 10th, the first bird comes back to its loft in Kent.
With a message or just like?
With a message.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and it's a message in German. A message in German that says, go F yourself.
That's right. Huh. So, and now the procedure that they'd established for returned birds was, loft owners were basically, like I mentioned, they were told nothing about operations. They weren't allowed to know where their bird was being taken or dropped. They were basically instructed, if you've submitted birds for a drop and you have some out, you just be vigilant. Mm-hmm. And if a bird returns, then you remove the cylinder from their leg. Under no circumstances are you to open the cylinder, not just for its top secret reasons, but I think because they had given rice paper and pencils, and things would be rolled up pretty tightly. They wanted to be really, like, careful that after all that effort, someone didn't just tear the whole thing in half.
Right.
Or spill their drink on it or whatever. So the process was, if they had a phone, which was rare, they could call a special number. Or I think, from what I can tell, normally a child on a bicycle would ride to take it to the local pigeon supply officer, who would then contact London. They'd send a motorcycle dispatch to pick it up, take it back to London.
It's very good. In you're describing the movie very well. You've already, right? You've already written the script.
I've, like, watched it in my head so many times. I can just see it. So Mellon and Sanderson, that morning, they get their message phoned into them. It had come from Le Briel in northern France. And would you like to hear it?
Yes.
Okay, so the message says, "Pigeon found Wednesday 9th at 8 a.m. The German troop movements are always at night. There are 50 Germans in every commune. There is a large munitions dump at Herzila, 200 meters from the railway station. Yesterday, a convoy of horse artillery passed towards Dunkirk via Bembeck and another to Hazebrouck. The Bosches do not mention an invasion of England. Their morale is not too good. The RAF have never bombed these parts. They should come to bomb the brickworks, as the proprietor is a..." Here the translator write, the next word was illegible, which is unlikely. And then he ends his message with, "I await your return. I am and remain a Frenchman." Signed, wow. ABCD34. Isn't that amazing?
What a heroic and phenomenal first message to get back.
Definitely a good start, right?
Like, ABCD really understood the assignment.
He answered every question on the list. And so they get their second message that same day from Flanders. That one, I'm not sure what it contains. I was able to, so Carrera includes some transcripts of the messages. I also have another little book from an American journalist put together some scans of the original, not the original, like, rice paper messages, but they would get translated onto these pink sheets of paper.
Right.
And with, like, the notes at the top of a number message and everything. And so, and then there's a website that has transcriptions of a few.
Uh-huh.
And so I've combed through everything I could find trying to find my family's. And I haven't seen it. But it's kind of amazing. Some of them are more useful than others, for sure.
Right.
But it's a really fascinating glimpse into just, like, the civilian experience at that point in time. I would love to see the whole thing, like the whole, there is no, Carrera mentioned in his book that there is no single place right now. They're all at the National Archives at Kew, but they're in different sort of caches and places. So yeah, it would be amazing to read. I think, well, we'll get to how many there were in total, but so they do a second drop in May of 1941. That one was less successful. Some pigeons returned, but no useful info, really. Just a couple pigeons returned, I think. But they're starting to get the feel that, like, okay, people are willing to resist in this way. Like, there are people who are willing in their small way to participate. Some more helpful than others. Like I said, one got sent back with no troops here, but didn't identify where here was. So
good.
Yeah, thanks, buddy.
Yeah.
They were discovering that, again, similar to what happened with my family, most birds were being discovered by farmers in the morning in their fields.
Sure.
And so
they farmers were very good at gossip, but also, you know, not always the ones that have their ear to the word on the street.
True. Very true. But the messages would sometimes find their way to the people who did have their, you know, ear to the street. They would sometimes find their way to people who'd already melded into little groups of resistance.
Oh, cool.
And so those people were sending a little bit more. Not only were they sending intelligence, but they were also sending intel about what they were doing.
Yeah.
So then there were a lot that included pleas for food because of the Germans requisitioning all the food. So by July 1941, they do a review of the first 3 months of Project Columba. They sent 221 birds to Flanders, Normandy, and Brittany. 46 came back.
Amazing.
19 with messages. And 17 of those messages contain some useful information.
That's great.
So good start, right? So they were very pleased with the freshness of the intel. These birds were coming back sometimes within 7 hours. Like the ones in France were back in no time.
Right.
So they're getting very fresh intel. And it was also pretty economical because the planes were going anyway.
Yeah.
And the pigeons were donated.
Right.
So it's decided this is going to, the operation's going to continue. It's going well. And within days of that report being released, the most important message of the entire project comes in, called Message 37.
Message 37. Do tell.
All right. So we're going to pivot, and I'm going to tell you another story that starts with a farmer in a field, this time in Lichtervelde, Belgium. And this farmer finds a pigeon in a container in his field. It's July of 1941. And, you know, like we talked about, this is the crucial moment, right? Like, what in that moment, you have to make a choice. What are you going to do? The Germans at this point were just starting to go, hey, what's that?
Right.
They themselves used pigeons to communicate, so they weren't, you know, it wasn't a surprise, but I think they were starting to realize it was happening, and it would, their sort of counter techniques to try to stop this would escalate steadily. But so already by this point, I think people were aware that it was probably dangerous to be caught with one.
Well, yeah, because all they would have to do is catch you with an empty pigeon bomb.
That's right.
And then they would say, where's the pigeon?
Or a bird with a British ring on its leg.
Right.
In your loft of not British pigeons. So there's lots of ways you could get caught. But this guy, you know, I think, as we also discussed, for sure there were people who they did open that carton, but they were starving. And
ate the bird seed?
Yeah, John, they ate the bird seed.
Yeah.
So,
no, they ate the pigeon is what you're saying.
They ate the pigeon. I think the pigeon became meals on plenty of occasions.
Right.
You know, but this particular farmer was like, you know what? I'm going to support the resistance on this. He knew a local family who both had a pigeon loft and he considered to be patriots and would support the resistance. So he gave the carton to his wife and she hid it in a sack of potatoes and she rode her bicycle to this family ran a local grocery store. So they had a big house. It was half house, half grocery store. And this family is called the Debailles. And there's five siblings living there. are seen, Gabriel and Michelle, the three brothers, and two sisters, Marie and Margaret. After some debate, they decide, you know what? This pigeon found its way to us. Let's do this. Let's spy for England.
Yeah.
And so they decide they'll take the risk. They reach out to two friends that they feel pretty certain they can trust and who will help them. And so they, there's a Catholic priest they know named Father Joseph Raskin, and they knew him because he'd been a missionary in China with one of their other brothers. And then through him, they'd met his friend, a man named Hector. I'm not sure how to say his name. It's J-O-Y-E. I feel like it might be Joya, or
let's go with that.
We'll go with Joya. So Raskin and Joya. Raskin, the priest, was born in 1892. He had become a priest, joined the Belgian missionary network, known as the Shoytists or Shoyt missionaries. And he, during World War I, had been a stretcher bearer. He was captured at one point, sort of ironically, as a spy. Ironic because he wasn't spying then. But he escaped, returns to the front, is a stretcher bearer there. And while he's there, he starts doing a hobby that he was really into as a kid. He was an amazing artist. And so he starts drawing what he sees. And his superiors start to see what he's doing. He's like drawing these really elaborate examples of the German trenches. And they're like, this guy's skill might be useful. So they pull him as a stretcher bearer and they put him to work as like a intelligence gatherer, basically. He would do these amazing drawings and watercolors of the view from the Belgian side, and then would carefully mark out each German position and like send that on up. Not realizing at the time that this was good practice in preparing him for what he was going to be doing later. After the war, he goes to China, becomes a missionary, spends a decade there before he comes back to Brussels, and working as a traveling preacher. About a year after Belgium's occupied, he gets a call from Arsène de Bailly. And the next day, he's at their farm looking at a pigeon and some sheets of rice paper. So they decide they're going to separate and travel around and collect as much intel as they can. So he goes driving along the coast, Arsène goes driving along the coast, goes to Bruges. The other brother, under cover of selling feed, which is one of the family's businesses, he's doing the local area. Raskin goes to Brussels. He has some contacts through his Catholic missionary work. And in particular, one woman named Madame Roberts, who was already involved in a network of getting Belgian soldiers and people out of Belgium. So she was active in the sort of moving people from house to house, attic to attic, getting clothes, food, that kind of stuff. So he connects with her. So they collect all of this intel, they put it together. They're going to send it off to London. Raskin uses his skill as an artist.
He draws actual diagrams. How much can this pigeon carry?
He draws it. So the rice sheets are about, I don't know, like 12 by 12, I think.
Okay.
So they're big. And he draws really detailed maps. And he also, while he was in China, studied calligraphy. And so he writes these amazing teeny tiny characters and like little tiny bunched together words that you need a magnifying glass to see. Okay, so they write this down. He finishes it all off with a symbol. It's a circle with a curly L inside of a V. They call themselves Leopold Vindictive. They release this bird. It goes back to England. And the families actually still have the drafts of that message, which is really cool. You can see them in the book.
But it's not in the archives. We don't actually have the...
They don't have the rice paper, I don't think.
Okay.
Oh, wait. No, there's a photo. I think there is a photo.
Oh, wow.
They don't have the original rice paper, but I think there's a photo for the maps. So intelligence makes its way back to MI-14, and they can't believe what they're seeing.
Right.
Decades later, Sanderson describes that message as the most exciting and romantic of all the reports he's seen.
Right.
So it opens with the line in English, this message is from Leopold Vindictive 200. And then the rest is in French, and it gives precise instructions about where bombs would need to be dropped. Chateau near Bruges, that was a communications installation for the Germans that England had not known about. And a bunch of other really, really heavily useful intel.
Right.
He also gives them a way to identify him. So he has them reach out to an admiral in England who was with him with the king on a specific day in May when Belgium basically surrendered. They both had happened to be there. And so he gives, he says, ask what he says, identify me as follows. I'm the bearded military chaplain who shook hands with Admiral Keyes on the morning of May 27th, 1940 at 7:30 a.m. Ask the Admiral, please, where he was exactly at that moment with my most respectful greetings.
Wow. So he's giving himself away if the Germans intercept this pigeon, but how would you intercept a pigeon? You would have to, you couldn't really. As soon as the pigeon.
They could shoot it down.
Right.
And they did.
Not this
they
one.
They definitely tried. Not this one, yeah. Thankfully. No, not this one. So they confirm this. Keyes is like, yeah, there was a chaplain there. It's interesting because Raskin's name isn't yet mentioned at this point in the notes, so it's either Keyes didn't remember his name or maybe they were trying to keep it secret.
Yeah.
But they are like blown away. They show this message to Churchill himself.
Right.
And so one of the sisters' jobs was to scan the BBC broadcast for receipt because that was one of the ways that they were communicating to people who asked for confirmation of receipt of the message that they that they send the message.
Right. Cool coded messages on the radio.
So on 2 days later, 2 days after they get the message, the answer appears on the BBC. Leopold Vindictive, the key fits the lock and the bird is in the lion's cage. What happens next is just like a series of missed connections. Raskin had included like send more pigeons and he included a way of using a map and Admiral Key's knowledge of where they were that day to locate the field that they wanted the pigeons dropped in. They get all this, you know, he's giving them all this information about how they can send pigeons, what days, if the weather's bad those days, these days. And what happens is just like a comedy of errors for the next almost year where they're desperately trying to get messages back to Britain and MI-14 and Sanderson and Mellon are desperately trying to figure out how to get more pigeons to them. And it just keeps not happening.
Right.
The planes are diverted because of bad weather. The pilot drops them in the wrong field. The Leopold Vindictive, in the meantime, is like, why, you know, they're hearing no messages. They're not getting any pigeons. They start to get more desperate. So they're starting to try to figure out other ways to get a message to London.
Sure.
And they start reaching out to other people in the network, in the resistance networks
right.
in Belgium.
But increasing their danger exponentially.
Correct. And Britain itself, or Belgium itself, was kind of dangerous in that they were, it was very small in the networks. You know, there were two groups that were dropping. By this point, they've started trying to drop agents in. So MI6 and the Special Operations Executive, which was more like sabotage, propaganda, yeah. help the resistance. Like they were the like new kids on the block. And MI6 hated them. And
right.
there was so much drama between the agencies, both back home, that bled into the on the ground in occupied territory stuff.
Yeah, that spy mean girls stuff is real serious.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
That was one of the things that surprised me the most. I was like, come on, guys. People are risking their lives for you. Get it together.
Yeah.
But they didn't. And so they were trying to get their hands on a radio set, which was very few and far between. They were trying to get a message. Not only did they want more pigeons and to specify some dates, but they wanted to change their name because Raskin started second guessing and realized after talking to somebody else that King Leopold was still in the country, had surrendered but refused to leave. And he was worried that would somehow come back on him. And so he's like, we need a name change, a rebrand, and we need pigeons. So he starts connecting with these various different groups in Belgium at that time. And in Brussels, there is a German military intelligence officer named George Boddicker, who is already starting to try to infiltrate these networks of people getting people out of the country. So what ends up happening is Raskin gets connected to one of the people who's running the Comet line, basically.
Running the what?
So one of the networks that was transporting both British airmen and Belgian soldiers and people who wanted to get out through France and through the Pyrenees to Spain was called the Comet Line.
Oh.
So the Comet Line was being run by a couple people and they get connected with him and they're going to try to get use him to get a message out back to England.
Yeah.
Essentially, before they're able to do that, Boddicker, the German agent who's in Brussels and trying to infiltrate that, has infiltrated that network, and there's a series of arrests that are made.
Boo, German intelligence.
Right? So they, Raskin's arrested, the one of the brothers is arrested, and Hector Joy is arrested as well. So the three men who are doing the bulk of the intelligence collection are arrested, as well as a bunch of people around them. For a chunk of time there, the intelligence coming from Belgium is pretty bad. They had commandeered some radio sets that had come in with dropped agents, and were using the agents in the radio sets to communicate back to England. So leading into 1943, most of Britain's intelligence from Belgium was actually the Germans. So, right? Not good. But they're continuing to send their messages. They're continuing to, back in England, they're still using the pigeon drops. They're still collecting intelligence. I don't know if you're familiar with Reginald Jones, who was, he was part of MI6, and he was one of the only champions at MI6 for this project. But he was able to use pigeons to locate. So he was trying to solve the radar problem. He was like, how are these night fighters shooting down these planes? So he's able to use Operation Columba to get intelligence so they can find these radar stations, make it safer for the RAF pilots. And in, near the end of the war, he also was able to use it to get specific intelligence about the V1 and V2 rockets that started flying. So they were actually able to find 10 emplacements.
Oh, nice.
Through
pigeon. Through
the pigeons.
Oh, nice.
Exactly. So as things are heating up at the end of the war, they start, they're doing regular drops basically from Denmark all the way down to Bordeaux. More intel is coming in, like we talked about earlier, probably because the writing was on the wall and people were realizing that, like, okay, the end is nigh. Like, let's do this. Raskin and Debye and Joy are all moved to Wuppertal in Germany, and then to another place and face a trial. And basically,
do they escape the war? They're not. This story doesn't end with them dying on the last day of the war, does it?
So unfortunately, so they were arrested pretty early on. They were arrested in late 42.
Right.
So they got their pigeon in 41. That whole year was like a series of missed opportunities, and they had collected. So during that year, they compiled what would have been some insanely valuable intelligence. And the families still have those maps because they remained, I believe, at least Joy's remained hidden and never found. And so like it would have been, they had mapped, and you talked about the batteries, like the coastline and what they'd done. So they had mapped 67 kilometers of the coastal defenses along Belgium's coast.
Oh, man.
And like in like a really elaborate detail, it would have helped for things like Dieppe. It would have helped, like the intelligence they collected would have helped with the Allied invasion. So it was a definite missed opportunity. As the Allied forces are moving through, they've got their intelligence. They've, you know, used it for, like I said, to help with locating the radar stuff and the rockets. They were actually pulled on board to be part of Operation Cockade, which was trying to convince the Germans that they were going to do a landing in Norway and France and elsewhere. It didn't work, but they used altered questionnaires that they dropped in locations to hope that the Germans would discern from that.
Yeah.
But so they start scaling it back in late 44. So my family would have got one of the last pigeons. Wow. I don't think they sent any more after September. In total, 900 and some messages returned. I think between 950 to 1,000 messages came back. And they formally wrapped it up in February of 45. The sad news is that the end of the war is when the three families find out what happened to their fates, like to their loved ones. And at the August 43 trial that they were given, they were all sentenced to death and were executed, unfortunately, in October of 43. fate did deal with the judge who sentenced and sentenced them to death. In February of 45, he was doing his People's Tribunal in Berlin, and an Allied bombing raid caused him to be crushed to death under a column in his courtroom. So there's that.
Yeah, the right. <good guys. laughs> Right. I mean, you know, you're pacing this exactly as the movie will go because, right, this is the... It doesn't have to be chronological. It's got a dramatic ending. The pillar falls on him.
They realize that, you know, that the value of the intelligence, they send out certificates to people that they've found. They start looking for people who helped them. And they, in the end, it's sort of the interest again sort of wraps up and trickles down, you know, trickles away in terms of using pigeons for any kind of stuff. Although it's possible that they were used in Cold War stuff.
For sure, like, they were.
Yeah, I think some of that stuff is actually still classified.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the reality is I think maybe it might be useful, you know, as we're preparing for the apocalypse.
Sure, after the great cataclysm. I mean, right? But by then they'll probably be sentient pigeons.
Or the next bigger than Carrington event that wipes out the entire power grid. Like, we might want some pigeon lofts.
There it is, right? The pigeons, I mean, it does feel also like a kind of potentially a millennial Gen Z affectation, along with like curly Q mustaches, like keeping pigeons.
Keeping pigeons, 100%.
Yeah, right, right.
So yeah, so that's the story of Operation Columba and Leopold Vindictive, and the 900, like I said, I think it's between 950 around there. Messages are all at Kew Gardens, National Archives at Kew. If there's any futurelings who want a mission and want to go try to find that message.
Well, I feel like you and I ought to get the rights to this book and start collaborating on a script. Yeah.
I can see it in my head now. It's I was very pleased. I was interested. And then when I dove into the story, I was like, this is so much more compelling than I thought any of this was going to be. I mean, there's a whole other piece of like, so check out the book if because it's totally worth it. There's a whole other piece of like the infighting between the intelligence groups. There's a reference to a Bloomsbury group adjacent person who enters the story for a brief window. So it's like just the like layers of it I was so fascinated by it.
Yeah. Well, you've done a marvelous job. That was, you know, so much about it. And this was an extremely fascinating episode. And I'm very much casting our movie even now. Yeah. I just feel like I can picture the whole, because there are a lot of strong female leads too. Like this movie has really everything. So
I think we can even get like a trilogy out of this.
And that concludes Operation Columba, entry 869.GE0810. Certificate number 23861 in the omnibus. Futurelings, I hate social media, and I'm sure you do too. We disavow it, and yet we contribute to it here at the Omnibus Project. Anywhere you put in Omnibus Project, you will find we are there beavering away. Fans of the show can be found anywhere that futurelings congregate. Just type in the sobriquet futurelings and they will be throughout the internet. You can email us and we will receive your email at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can send us physical mail to The Omnibus Project, 609 Southwest 150th Street, number 48084. Burien, Washington, 98166-9998. Our show is listener supported at patreon.com/omnibusproject. Thank you for helping us continue to keep the show on the air. We have a lot of special stuff behind the paywall at Patreon, including outtakes of the shows, show notes, photographs of ephemera, contributions from our co-hosts, supporting documentation and a large backlog of addenda shows featuring former co-host Ken Jennings and merch items for different tiers. Lots and lots of exclusive content there. So go to patreon.com/omnibusproject and join the community.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. If the worst comes soon, then this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese, and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.